Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Foreign exchange markets are nobody's idea of a good time. Currency trading doesn't really affect most of us day to day. Until it eventually does. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner was talking exchange rates today, and he is not a happy camper. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 6th of October. Good to have you with us. The magic in Secretary Geithner's speech on foreign exchange rates this morning wasn't so much in what he said as in what he left unsaid.
We believe it's very important to see more progress by the major emerging economies to more flexible market-oriented exchange rate systems.
Major emerging economies the White House wants to see progress from? That'd be China.
This is particularly important for those countries whose currencies are significantly undervalued.
China.
This is a problem because when large economies with undervalued exchange rates
China.
Act to keep their currencies from appreciating,
China.
That encourages other countries to do the same.
Other countries, Brazil and Japan, to name just two of them. There has been a rash of countries the past couple of weeks trying to keep their currencies low as one way to help them get out of recession. It's not really a trade war of the usual sort, but currency manipulation is economically offensive to some. Marketplace Jeremy Hobson is on the front lines of it in New York City. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Kai.
What exactly might a currency war be?
Oh, you can't hear the money flying in the background behind me. I'm right on the front lines. But it's basically a race to the bottom. All the countries in the world want to get their currencies down as far as they can in value so that they can export their way out of this global recession. You mentioned China. They've got a very undervalued currency. That means that it's very cheap for us to buy their stuff. We buy probably more of it than we should. They don't want to buy very much of our stuff because they can't afford as much, and therefore we have a widening trade gap with China. So in a currency war, everybody wants to adopt that Chinese approach of bringing their currency down as far as they possibly can so that they can boost their exports.
Give me the basics, though, Jeremy. What's the key of boosting exports?
Well, because right now in this global slump, the world's economy is just not growing fast enough for everyone to sell as much stuff as they want. So they want to put things on sale for everyone else to come in and buy. We can call it the Columbus Day sidewalk sale. Here's Eric Valoria, who's a senior currency strategist at Forex.com.
You know, if a store is carrying a lot of inventory and they're having problems to try and sell that inventory, they're going to reduce the prices. What's happening with the countries is just on a broader sense where you're reducing the value of your currency in order to try and increase your exports and sell those goods.
And Kai, the countries that some point to as key players in this currency war are Brazil, Peru, and Japan. And you remember, I'm sure, we reported just yesterday that in Japan, the central bank took some steps to bring down the value of the yen and get the economy going again.
All right, so central banks can do some things. What else can countries do? What do they do to make their money cheaper?
Well, they can sell some of their own money and buy another country's bonds. That will do two things. It pushes their currency down, and it also pushes the currency of the other country up. Here's an example. A lot of global investors bought dollars after the financial crisis because they were scared of losing their money, and U.S. bonds are still seen as a very safe place to put your money. That pushed the dollar up. But now that the Fed here in the U.S. is pumping so much money into the economy, you can't make that much money on government bonds anymore. So a lot of investors are deciding to put their money in emerging economies where they can get better returns, places like Thailand and Indonesia. And that's pushing currencies in those countries higher. So they're having to worry about the value of their currencies. And they've decided pretty much across the board that they want to bring their currencies down.
Yeah. You know, Jeremy, the foreign exchange markets are this big sort of indecipherable box. How would we know if we're in a currency war?
Well, it's very difficult to know. It's not like an ordinary war where you have ships coming into the harbor and you know you're in trouble. One guy I speak to often on currency stories, a guy named Mark Chandler, who's the head of global currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman, says we are definitely not in a war.
If people are trying to weaken their currencies, they've done a horrible job at it because all their currencies are higher. The only East Asian currency that's down for this year is the Hong Kong dollar, and that's pegged to the U.S. dollar, and it's down like 0.01%.
0.01%, Kai, and that is not, Mark Chandler says, a reason to change your habits on what you're buying. You're not going to decide to buy an iPad or a car from another country based on a tiny little change like that in the currency. But obviously, Treasury Secretary Geithner is worried. He's warned countries that undervaluing their money can lead to asset bubbles and inflation. And the Obama administration is pushing for this to be an issue to be brought up at this weekend's IMF meeting in Washington. So we haven't heard the last word on this.
Jeremy Hobson in New York, our currency war correspondent at the Bureau there. Jeremy, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Of this Wednesday on Wall Street, one can safely say, hey, it could have been worse. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Everybody with a hand in the American economy, from Timothy Geithner on down, whether they're talking about currency markets or economic stimulus or tax policy right now, is really talking about one thing. Here's commentator Robert Reich.
Everyone's worried about jobs, understandably. In all likelihood, this Friday's jobs report will show that the job situation continues to be bleak. Some say the only way out is for jobless Americans to accept lower wages. But this way of thinking just substitutes one problem, lack of jobs, for another. I mean, we could create tens of millions of new jobs if everyone was willing to work for, say, $2 a day, which is the going rate in many developing nations, including China. It's no great feat to create jobs by becoming poorer. In fact, we're already doing it. Since the start of the Great Recession, millions of working Americans have had to settle for lower wages in order to keep their jobs. Or they've lost higher-paying jobs and can only find work that pays less. Or they've lost their benefits, or their co-pays, deductibles, and premiums have soared, and their employer no longer matches their 401k contributions. Two-tiered wage contracts are the rage in labor relations. Older workers stay at their previous wage. New hires get lower wages and smaller benefits. Even wage freezes morph into lower wages as inflation eats into the value of the dollar. For three decades now, America's median wage has barely budged, adjusted for inflation. Some say the best way to get jobs back is to push the dollar down relative to foreign currencies. A weaker dollar boosts our exports because everything we sell is then cheaper to foreign consumers. And more exports means more jobs. But this is just another way of creating jobs by getting poorer. A falling dollar means everything we buy from abroad becomes more expensive. Imports are around 18% of the U.S. economy, so a dropping dollar is exactly like an extra tax on 18% of what we buy. Don't be fooled. It's no big accomplishment to create more jobs by getting poorer. We're already on the way. The real goal is to create more good jobs.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor in the first Clinton administration. His new book is called Aftershock: The Next Economy and America's Future. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. What do you do if you're a major university and a sprawling research facility all's but falls right into your lap? You could go the traditional business incubator route, or you could do what the University of Michigan is doing and prepare to open up what's being called a venture accelerator. Jennifer Guerra reports now from Michigan Radio. It's a new strategy for universities that are trying to bring the fruits of their research to market.
When the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer left Ann Arbor, Michigan more than 3 years ago, it left behind the equivalent of a small town, a collection of 30 buildings, including science labs, a water plant, and drug factory, scattered across nearly 200 acres. The former research park is on land that had been owned by the University of Michigan, so the university decided to buy it back and turn the facility into a kind of business incubator on steroids.
In some ways, what we're really trying to do is create controlled chaos.
Doug Neal is with U of M's Center for Entrepreneurship, one of the groups affiliated with the project. He says in traditional incubators, collaborations with the private sector typically happen only after researchers have figured out how to translate their work into marketable products. In a twist, the University of Michigan is inviting venture capitalists, business development experts, and for-profit companies to set up shop in the new venture accelerator right alongside researchers. Daryl Weinert heads up the facility's Business Engagement Center.
You know, the idea is to make this a springboard for even more interactions with companies.
Floor plans call for big open spaces with comfy chairs, coffee bars, and whiteboards, where eventually more than 3,000 scientists, engineers, and others are expected to gather and share ideas. The center is scheduled to open next year, and Chris Ryzik is among the venture capitalists thinking about moving in. His investment fund holds nearly $50 million from some of Michigan's biggest corporations.
What I'd love to see is this kind of center where there's this constant feedback loop, feedback from venture capitalists or from corporations back to the researchers saying, you've got this great research, you know, here's a need for it. Can you do your research so that you're solving real problems out there in the world?
But some worry closer ties between university researchers and private industry could increase the potential for corporations to dictate how research is conducted. Sheldon Krimsky is the author of a book about university and industry collaborations called Science in the Private Interest.
Corporations are interested in getting things out on the marketplace. Well, universities traditionally have been interested in producing credible, objective knowledge. When you mix these two, the tendency is that the values of academia start to erode.
Officials with the University of Michigan Venture Accelerator say they plan to keep a close watch for undue corporate influence. At the same time, they see greater collaboration between business and academia as a key driver of innovation and job creation in the future. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, I'm Jennifer Guerra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We also value our relationships with India, with China. We want to do business with these places.
Except for some new British immigration rules. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets kind of didn't know what to do with themselves. Today, investors were reading the tea leaves on the U.S. labor market. Dow Industrials gained 22 points, 0.2%, ended at 10,967. The Nasdaq gave up 19 points, 0.8%, finished at 2380. The S&P 500 nicked off less than a point, closed at 1159. Meantime, gold rallied as the dollar weakened. Gold closed above $1,347 an ounce in New York today, its eighth high in 10 sessions. Other precious metals also gained, including palladium and platinum. A few semiconductor companies didn't retain their value after a Morgan Stanley downgrade. Xilinx fell almost 2.5% today. Altera gave up 2.25%. Consumer sales in foreign markets propped up some stocks today. Costco beat expectations when it posted a 16% jump in its fourth quarter earnings, much of that in its international operations. The wholesaler advanced more than 1% today. Financial shares were kind of mixed. Overseas, the Frankfurt DAX, the Paris CAC 40, and London's FTSE each brightened around 0.8%. Tokyo's Nikkei gained 1.8%. The price for the 10-year T-note rose some more. The yield fell to 2.39%. You're going to watch that one. You're going to want to watch that one, rather. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. By Mass Mutual, with financial professionals nationwide who are trained to serve the unique financial needs of their clients at massmutual.com. and by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly report on consumer credit. The Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions holds a hearing on retirement security in America. And the annual meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank Group get underway in the nation's capital. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are now smack in the middle of the back-to-school Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas retail crush that seems to get longer every single year. The National Retail Federation said today it expects holiday sales to be up over last year. It's not really saying all that much if you happen to remember last year when stores practically had to give things away just to get shoppers in the door. Even though this season might be a little bit brighter, that deep discount thing probably isn't going to change all that much, as Janet Babin reports.
The forecast from the National Retail Federation sounds good. Sales this season are expected to rise 2.3%. That's the biggest increase in 3 years. But that gain is going to come at a price. Deep discounts to lure reluctant shoppers could mean weaker profits for retailers. RJ Hottovy is a retail analyst at Morningstar.
It's really been a tug of war between retailers and consumers on this front, and frankly, it's one that the consumers have been winning the last year or two.
And will likely win again. Hottovy says a few stores have attempted to raise prices, but that's a gamble most retailers can't afford to take. Many are engaged in price wars. Instead, he says stores have gotten creative with promotions, pushing layaways or special deals.
Just doing different things with their promotional strategies, you know, timing promotions and or maybe even couponing, where if you buy something earlier in the month and you get a coupon for later in the month.
And to keep more profit from what they do sell, retailers have tamped down operating expenses. Scott Krugman's with the National Retail Federation.
That's why I think you see retailers looking carefully at their staffing models and making sure they don't have any more staff in the stores than they need at any particular time.
That could affect holiday hiring, and you may have to spend a little more time in line to buy electronics. Flat-screen TVs, video games, and iPads are expected to be the big sellers this season. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
If you're talking online retail, you have to talk Amazon. It owns 8% of all online sales. Other retailers have been struggling for more than a decade to figure out how to fight back against them, and they think they have finally hit on a soft spot, Amazon's shipping costs. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
More than 40 national retailers, from Toys R Us to Calvin Klein, are teaming up to offer customers unlimited shipping on all online purchases from any of these stores for just $79 a year. The new service, called ShopRunners, intended to lure loyal customers away from Amazon, which also offers a $79 all-you-can-ship deal. They're after loyal customers like Jeremy Wallace Segal, who's on Amazon a lot.
A couple of times a month at least, plus I have some Amazon subscriptions. They send me diapers and wipes and Special K every few months.
He's never run the numbers on Amazon Prime.
I've never sat down to do the math on whether I'm paying more or less for delivery charges than I would if I wasn't using Amazon Prime.
But Wallace is pretty sure he's saving money, and the program keeps him coming back. That's exactly the idea, says Brian Walker, an analyst at Forrester Research. Even though the company probably loses money on shipping, it more than makes it up on volume. But Walker's not convinced this strategy will work for stores joining ShopRunner.
It's much more difficult to achieve as a network of retailers because that consumer may only order from that particular online retailer once or twice a year.
And without repeat customers, big shipping discounts don't make sense. While ShopRunner has managed to unite dozens of different businesses, it's still a much smaller online mall than Amazon. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Mexico has been having its share of troubles the past couple of years, drug violence in particular. But investors are taking the long view, the really long view. Yesterday, the bond market lent the Mexican government $1 billion for 100 years. It's the biggest sale of what are called century bonds on record, the first in Latin America. It's also a ringing endorsement of emerging markets as investors chase some higher returns. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Mexico offered bond buyers a 6% annual return. That's an attractive rate for institutional investors like pension fund managers who can only get less than 2.5% for U.S. Treasury bonds. So they jumped at the chance to lock in a good yield. The vote of confidence doesn't surprise Pepperdine finance professor Ed Fredericks, who says Mexico's stock market is up over 8% this year.
There's industry there, and there's a developing middle class. So I think the market there is seen very attractive.
Mexico is just one of several emerging markets where foreign money is flowing these days. Indonesia, Brazil, and Chile are among the growing economies finding lots of appetite for their bonds. Roger Nussbaum, the chief investment officer for Your Choice Financial, says those countries are more attractive than Mexico. He's worried about possible debt defaults and the drug violence there.
Mexico relies on tourism, of course, from the U.S. to the extent this threatens that cash cow for them. Clearly, it's one more leg of the stool that becomes wobbly.
The amount of foreign interest in emerging market debt is good news for countries that not long ago were struggling to stay afloat, says Ramin Talui, emerging markets portfolio manager at PIMCO.
Concerns about levels of indebtedness in the industrial world have provided the incentive for many investors to look for opportunities in emerging markets.
He expects those opportunities will be around for a while, given the recent instability of the banking system in developed countries. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Britain's Conservative Party wrapped up its annual convention today. Prime Minister David Cameron is trying to rally the party faithful. He's got a new austerity budget to sell. And among other campaign promises, sharp limits on immigration. Much as it does here, the immigration debate over in the UK turns on jobs. Who gets to come in and what skills do they bring? By law, the Brits can't keep European Union workers out. They can cap the number of non-Europeans, though. But can they do it without hurting the key to the British economy? The City of London. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
In the Canary Wharf Financial District, work is underway on a major new rail link called Crossrail. It will pass underneath part of the capital. But even before tunnelling begins, the $25 billion project hit an obstacle. Joe Valentine is head of London First, a business advocacy group.
We need skills from overseas, in particular tunnelling engineering skills, and we're just going to do the project badly if we can't bring those people in to help us build Crossrail.
Crossrail could be a casualty of the immigration cap, and not the only one. Among others affected, this small London firm of architects.
Do you think it should be wider, though, or longer?
I would say that it might be better if it was a bit smaller.
Indian architect Swapna Bikali has worked here for almost a year, but because of the cap, her visa's been withdrawn. She'll be kicked out of Britain next month.
Not being able to continue working just because of the visa criteria and not based on your skill, it's very disappointing.
You feel rejected by this country?
Yeah, a bit.
Swapna's boss, James Burrell, says her departure is a setback for his firm.
Because of the recession, we were looking to develop our business abroad. We are currently looking into India. It's a growth marketplace, and Swapna was going to assist us with that process.
London is the most globalised city on earth. Its banks and brokerages, law firms, accountants and architects do business around the planet. This city is constantly forging links with the rest of the world.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now in Canada Square, the heart of Canary Wharf.
An official takes a group of foreign business people on a tour of Canary Wharf, showing off the facilities. Back in her office, business advocate Jo Valentine frets about the cap on non-European immigration. She fears that it risks alienating some of London's most important customers.
We also value our relationships with America, with India, with China hugely. We want to do business with these places. We shouldn't be by mistake giving the impression to people that we don't value them and don't want them in London.
But the Conservative Party, which is now in government, promised during the last election to curb immigration, pledging to cut the influx drastically from more than 200,000 migrants a year down to tens of thousands. You can't do that without a cap, says Conservative lawmaker Nicholas Bowles.
Our public services are under strain, our communities are under some strain, some of them, and we also have lots of unemployed British people with skills who we need to be getting into work.
But many of the businesses based in London say there are not enough smart, educated Brits to go around. They have to recruit from abroad. And foreign companies setting up here will always want to bring at least some of their own staff in. Stuart Fraser chairs the local government committee responsible for London's financial centre. He says the immigration cap will benefit London's competitors.
We would see people move out of London to other cities where they can bring in their people from around the world.
New York, for example, well, might benefit.
Absolutely right. We're shooting ourselves in the foot and giving New York a hugely competitive edge.
This is a great day for London.
Last year, the Mayor of London launched the Crossrail project, driving in the first pile at Canary Wharf.
3, 2, 1, go!
He said the new rail link would make London even more attractive as a place to do business. But he too has now warned the government that its immigration cap could threaten this project and the prosperity of the capital as a whole. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. You can ask your financial advisor about Putnam 529 for America or visit putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, one that is sadly not ripped from the pages of The Onion. For want of a $75 fee, the Cranick family of Obion County, Tennessee, has lost its home. The county contracts with the nearby town of South Fulton for fire services in rural areas, hence the fee. Mr. Cranick forgot to pay that fee this year, even though he'd been up to date in years past. When a fire broke out near his house last week, he called the fire department. They checked their records. The house burned to the ground. Neither the mayor of South Fulton nor the city manager are taking anybody's phone calls. And on this Wednesday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 22 points, 0.2%. Ended things at 10,967. The NASDAQ gave up 19 points, 0.8%, 2380 at the bell. The S&P 500 lost less than a point. It closed just about where it started, 1159. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this show. When I say boomtown, what do you think?
It's not a boomtown in terms of the stereotypical 1870s boomtown of the Wild West. That we are not.
We'll pay a visit to the 2010 version. It's Fort McMurray, Canada. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.